Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 84 of the Friendly Ex-Muslim podcast. I'm your host, Abdullah Samir. Today, I have a very special guest. All my guests are very special, but Mikhail, which is a pen name, is a very interesting individual. Normally, when we do the pre-screening calls, I just talk for like 10, 15 minutes with the individual. But with Mikhail, we were on the phone for like an hour or something. We like went through the whole story. It was quite a journey, quite an intense story. So I'm looking forward to you guys all learning from and, you know, hearing this conversation. Mikhail is an ex-Muslim, a native Arabic speaker who memorized the Quran. We'll talk about that. Came to Canada at the age of 19 to become an engineer. He did 6 years of school, bachelor's and master's degree, and works in an energy research company. Mikhail, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Samir?
good. So let's go back to the beginning. Maybe not the beginning, but you memorized the Quran. How old were you when you memorized the Quran?
I was 15.
Oh, nice. So that was a while ago then. And you just left Islam recently, right? This is a very new thing to you.
Yeah, 3 weeks ago.
Wow. So you were probably the youngest ex-Muslim in terms of like just leaving Islam that I've ever talked to. So this is going to be fun. This is going to be interesting. And before we had the conversation, of course, you know, I had this conversation with you to discuss whether you were okay with it, because coming out and talking about these things, it's never easy. You know, I don't think people necessarily understand just how difficult it can be to come on camera and talk about these things in front of the public. There's, you know, always a risk of repercussion and stuff like that. But we do it because we care and we want to, you know, express ourselves. We want to share our stories. How are you feeling right now?
Much better than 3 weeks ago. I think I'm jumping to the very end of the story here, but the moment I realized, it sort of came to me as a sudden thought that there was no God, you know, and that since that moment, I felt that my mind has opened up to sort of regions, thoughts, questions that I've kept behind very thick walls for a very long time. I've avoided them because I feared God. I feared the punishment and the wrath of Allah, right? But yes, I feel much better, much happier. I see the grass greener, the snow is whiter, and it's you know about all the snow. It's really snowing around here these days.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so it's I always remember from the Quran, and I quote, وَمَنْ أَعْرَضَ عَنْ ذِكْرِي فَإِنَّ لَهُ مَعِيشَةً ضَنْكًا.
Forget.
And by the way, it's always he. It's always he. Yeah, it was meant for the guys, this religion. And yeah, so he who does not listen to the word of God and remember God and worship God, they deserve basically a life of dunka, which is depressed, very, very dark life, like unhappy life. So yeah, it's funny. God, if he can't smite you with a lightning, or, you know, he will just make you depressed. So it's many ways to torture you.
So I'm glad to hear that you're doing well, because, you know, for a lot of people that I've spoken to, they're not doing well. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong about leaving Islam. It's just that there's a very painful phase to go through to get to that point of like peace and tranquility. For me, it was easy. Thankfully, I have a very liberal Muslim family, and the structures that were around me facilitated me leaving Islam in a very easy way. But, you know, for some people, you know, firsthand, like, it can be extremely difficult. And I'm glad that you're doing well. And that's really, really happy to hear that. We're going to talk about that at the end of your story. So let's go back to the beginning. Tell us about your upbringing.
So I was the third child. Mm-hmm. So there was my older brother. He's 6 years older. Older sister, 3 years older. And then me. And then 6 years after me came my younger sister. So there were two girls, two boys. at the age of eight, my mother and my father, they divorced. I mean, they didn't divorce. They separated and went on a court battle that lasted 7 years. And well, if both, I think mainly my mother played, well, both, I could say, played very dirty, you know, like pressuring their kids to testify and, you know, basically talking, you know, kind of talking about the other person's reputation publicly and at work during with the family. So they really went on each other's throats through that divorce. And I think, yeah, that was part of the reason it wasn't such a happy childhood. But it was mainly unhappy because of my mother's practices, basically, after my father left. But yeah.
So, so you grew up in Saudi. You grew up as in a religious family. Can you talk about your family's religious practices? Were you guys like the type of Muslims that like, yeah, you were, you know, Eid Muslims, or were you like Juma Muslims, or were you like practicing Muslims praying Bible?
We were very practicing. I mean, it's you cannot not pray five times a day. You cannot not fast Ramadan. It's not acceptable. I mean, it's serious. You know, it's there's no games. It's, you know, the government at that time, you know, did not play games because, well, there was religious police, right? And the religious police, if you have a shop open during prayer time, they will come and give you a warning, maybe even arrest you and escort you to the mosque. So
escort you to the mosque.
Oh yeah, they were one of my. You know, it's funny. I'll mention this religion. I mentioned this story. It's really funny. But I'll get back to, you know, a question about my family. Yeah. So, you know, this is a story of a friend of mine who was very religious at high school. And he got out religious by the religious police. So he was managing his father's restaurant. It's called Ruz Bukhari, the Bukhari rice. It comes from a Eastern European sort of food. And anyone from Saudi Arabia would know that about Ruz Bukhari. So anyway, so he was managing his father's restaurant. They're originally from Afghanistan. But he is very religious, and he was memorizing the Quran as well. Didn't finish it like me, but he was memorizing a big chunk of it. And anyway, during the prayer time, basically he was just closing up and counting the money and making sure everything is tipped up before he goes to prayer. Mm-hmm. And he did close the light and sort of close the front door of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so then, but you know, unlucky for him, the religious police showed up. And they saw him inside, so they knock on the glass. It's like, open. And he comes and open. It's like, why are you not at prayer? It's like, you know, the adhan just happened, you know, and I'm just closing and getting ready to go. This guy has a beard like this. He was religious. Yeah. Anyway, so they told him, when prayer comes, when the adhan comes, you leave everything and you go. He got out religious by the religious police. So anyway, so they took him, escorted him to the prayer. They prayed together. Then they took him back to the restaurant, and then they gave him a warning.
what does it? I'm just laughing because I think a lot of these people just get off on the power trips. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm going to show you who's in charge. You know, like
it's certainty, you know, it's like, yeah. Okay, you have to be certain, you know, and in Islam, you have to be certain. You can't doubt.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the easiest way to remove your own doubt and get rid of your own doubt? Well, by flexing your religious muscle on the other people.
Yeah.
So it's like it boosts your own. Your own beliefs, and at the same time, well, you keep the doubters in line. You know
what happened to him because of that? Like, what did?
Oh, he just got a warning. But I mean, I guess because
How did it affect him?
I think he told me the story, and he was like very, very shocked. You know, But yeah, he, you know, I just like, you know, that time, if you think badly of the religious police, you know, like, yeah, you're not a proper Muslim, and you like God, وأمر بالمعروف ونهى عن المنكر. You know, it's like the, it's part of the religion to add, to say, to order, to do good things, and basically prevent people from doing bad things. And in Saudi Arabia at that time, now it's very different.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, at that time it was basically, yeah, if you're listening to music, if you're, who is this woman that's next to you? Is she not your sister and your mother? Well, none of your goddamn business, but like they do ask you, yeah? It's like, yeah, like there was a time that actually even people got annoyed because like they were stopping people, asking them, who is this woman to you?
Damn, holy, like this is like fascism. Like you can't have a freaking privacy of life.
Anyway, so, you know, many of the people that think, oh, Islam, like, you know, let's bring some Islam here. You know, like they really, you know, some of them are actually kind of naive, you know, it's sort of, they're sort of naive. They don't know how it is in a very conservative Muslim society. Well, I'll tell you, I lost all my childhood memory pictures because my uncle told my mom that this is like a recreation, like God, to take photos, like to recreate like God and to basically do the same thing as God is prohibited. And Ibn Baz, the like the very religious, is a very
mufti,
very 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 strict Salafi motherfucker. Like he was absolutely strict. You know, he like, no, pictures are haram. It's you know, like if you do take a picture in Yom Al Qiyamah in the, you know, the afterlife, basically God will bring you the photo and he will tell you, okay, well, put soul into it. And if you can, then he just flings you to the fires of hell. You know, so yeah, it's very strange. Anyway, so I lost all the albums, was burned because my mother decided to be religious and listen to my religious uncle, who later actually did something to my older sister, which I will come to that story.
Before we just, you know, go any further, I just want to share it on the screen, the hadith. So he's, you know, you guys are not, those of you Muslims who don't, like young Muslims who have never heard pictures being haram, it's right there in the hadith books. And I remember a time where, you know, hadith, it was a big part of the community that pictures are haram, photos are haram. I remember my grandma, she wouldn't let any of her daughters or sons take pictures of it. She's like, it's haram. And she's not, like, she was religious, but she was not educated. But this was common in the Muslim community. Even to this day, some Salafi scholars will not allow any videos to be taken. And, you know, some of them will, they've all come up with excuses now. Most of them, 99% of them.
That uncle that told my mom to burn the photos.
Yeah.
He now has a phone, like an iPhone, I think. And yeah, my father told me he saw him once. He met him once at a gathering. And basically he told me he had this rosemary, like the, you know, subha.
Oh, tasbih.
Yeah, the subha, yeah. So he had this, and it was like gold or something. Like, and yeah, you know, it's like this guy really is, you know, has embraced dunya, you know, but he's still, you know, he really embraced life, like, you know, freaking mentioning God's name, gold and rosemary.
That's so funny. It's like,
and he made our picture burn.
Oh my God.
He's not an asshole. Like, I mean,
yeah.
Whatever. I'll go back to my family. So yeah, you can tell from the stories. It's very religious family. My uncle, and that is, the main culprit in this whole story is this uncle was actually, I looked up to him as a child. He memorized the Quran. He had something called the ijaza is ijaza tahfaz. That is, it's like a very sophisticated way of saying I memorized the Quran. You know, it's basically to get a chain of hafaz. So if I was actually planning, after I finished the Quran, I was planning to recite the whole thing to that uncle, and basically get his chain, which is was 35 people between him and the Prophet. So basically, he recited it to his teacher. His teacher recited it to another guy. And, you know, the motherfucker chains basically goes to all the way to Gabriel.
To Allah. Yeah.
So, but anyway, it's so ridiculous now I think about it. Anyway, so I really looked up to him, and he was very religious. He studied fiqh, he studied hadith, he studied everything. And same thing with his brother, and the whole family was very religious. And anyway, but the thing is, what happened later in life, what I saw from them was like what many people would just say, oh, you know, there is bad Muslims. It is bad Muslims, you know. It's like it's not a big deal, you know. Even if you see those every Muslim around you doing shady crap, you know, that is haram in the religion, and you see them doing it, and then, well, you just say, oh, it's just Muslims, not the Islam itself. But anyway, I want to actually start with the story, you know, from not from the very beginning, but progress from the point where I sort of started to recognize my surrounding to the point where I left to Canada. So when I grew up, basically, I started, you know, I liked really, you know, memorizing poems, like reading poems. You know, I liked reading stories, you know, I liked literature. But the thing is that whatever I read, I really had passion for. I enjoyed everything. You know, I was a happy kid. I really liked everything. Even its history, like I listened to history cassette lectures for Tariq al-Suwaidan, if you know that guy.
Yes,
he's
yes.
Like one of the Muslim historians.
Yes.
So I listened to his whole stories about, like, from Adam to Muhammad, which is 5,000 years. But anyway, and then from Muhammad to, like, going to to basically the Ottoman Empire and that. But anyway, so I listened to a lot of the histories, and whatever I started reading and I listened to, I sort of liked it and I enjoyed it in some way. So anyway, so I at some point, yeah, I liked music, and I started listening to one of the Saudi artists at that time. His name was Muhammad Abdu. I listened to him. So then my religious uncle and the people, you know, came to my mom and they told them, music is haram, so you need to ask Muhammad to stop listening to that stuff. And so anyway, they took away my music. So I just started listening to the history lectures about Tariq al-Suwaidan and some other stuff. I started reading several books, Riyad al-Salihin, Kitab al-Bukhala. So I started reading into that. Anyhow, later on, what happened is that my mother and father's divorce got a little bit nasty. You know, and my mom sort of started treating me like I was my father, and she started she had like her own mental problems, and you know, she started saying to me that you remind me a lot of your father, and she would use like very very dirty language, you know, like to talk to her kids, even saying you're a bastard, you're this, and her beating sort of started getting more and more. I remember I was once beaten because I asked, we had a personal driver, mm-hmm. and I basically started growing mustache, and I was like asking him, how do you shave your mustache? I had no other father figure to ask because my father was away.
Yeah, yeah.
And I asked him, how do you shave? And he's like, yeah, you use this razor and you know, you can shave. So I took it from him, and then I started doing it and I cut myself. And she came and she saw me like cut myself, and for that reason, you know, she beat me like with a stick. It's like, I don't even know why. But the thing is that I've always remember my mom basically saying, I make a mistake. Like, for example, we go to guests and instead of taking one candy, I take three. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you're not supposed to take more than one candy. And then, and she's like, yeah, when we get back home, you're going to get something. And that is a very Arabic thing when they say, I'm going to get to you afterward. So, yeah, so always like the, you know, I started hating holidays just because whenever we went to visit family, I made a few etiquette mistakes. And basically, I was beaten to the point of, you know, like it's not just a slap on the wrist. It was wooden sticks, like the bamboo sticks, you know, like hangers, wood, plastic, iron, cables, like short, thin, wow. Thin, like charger cables, like cord extensions, everything you can think about. Wow. And, you know, at some point, she beat me to the point where I had an injury. Like it was the whole side of my knee was purple because she beat me like with a what was it? Like a broomstick, basically. And wow. And the reason was that my sister asked me to share a video game with her, and I told her to wait. That's wow. It. So anyway, my other siblings were also getting beaten a little bit, but the thing is that it was mostly me because I reminded her with my father.
Oh.
Yeah. And anyway, so life goes on. Fights really gets between, like, the relationship between me and my mom is getting really bad. You know, it's like something is telling me from inside, like I'm just depressed all the time.
Yeah.
Like I feel angry and I can't defend myself. Every time I tell people around me, they will tell me a verse from the Quran. وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا إِمَّا يَبْلُغَنَّ عِنْدَكَ الْكِبَرُ أَحَدُهُمَا أَوْ كِلَاهُمَا فَلَا تَقُل لَّهُمَا أُفٍّ وَلَا تَنْهَرْهُمَا وَقُل لَّهُمَا قَوْلًا كَرِيمًا. And that basically means obey God and obey Allah and obey the Prophet and your parents, and even if you grow up, like, never say to them "uff," which is basically don't even roll your eyes. Don't dare, you know. And you know, there's the hadith, you know, it's like ummuk thumma ummuk thumma ummuk thumma abuk. It's like, yeah, your mom. So my mother actually used that to basically make me hate my father.
Oh.
And then, yeah, so I sort of growed up, you know. Okay, well, we're gonna get tortured in hell. Allah is going to torture you, you know. And it's like, I just became so afraid of Allah, like a very early age, like at 8, you know, or 7, 9. And when I started like reading all that stuff in the Quran about hell and what would happen if you disobey your mom. And that just made me paralyzed, made me helpless.
Mm.
And everyone I talked about, they just, you know, cited the Quran. It's like, yeah, well, eat shit, basically.
Basically like brainless zombies.
Yeah. They don't sympathize. They're like, yeah. It's, you know,
and even I find if they do empathize, they don't really have any skills to help. It's just, oh, by the way, blah 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 blah, Quran, blah 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 blah, Hadith, oh blah blah blah, Muhammad said this, Muhammad did this. Okay, but how is that relevant to me? How is that going to help me? Like, this situation is not covered in these scenarios, right?
Yeah, it's not like it's like obey God, the Prophet, and your parents. But what if your mother like tries to kill you, like try to like inflict unbearable pain on you?
Yeah.
What if she never smiles to you? What if she never hugs you? What if she never said I love you? What if she, like, all of this was my mom, like she was almost, I think, like a psychopath, but you know, really had no, I did not have a good relationship with her. But even after she beats me, she goes and makes fun of me in front of my uncles.
Wow.
Like, she's like, yeah, I beat him up. I showed him who's the boss, you know, something like this, you know. And she would sit in front of me and she doesn't feel anything. And it's like, so I realized, you know, some psychopathy in that, you know, because, yeah, I don't excuse her, but sometimes I try to sympathize with even for her reason, because she's being a woman growing up in a society that suppressed women. And on top of that, you know, her father beat her really bad as well, mistreated her. I don't excuse her. And I want to see her punished, even because she's still the same bad mother to my other siblings.
Yeah. Today.
And she hasn't changed. So I would see her punished. But at the same time, I would still sympathize with her as a person. So when I decided to leave, I didn't leave on very good terms. And it was a fight because, you know, my mother started getting more and more upset with me because I would refuse to go to court. I told her, like, yeah, you know, between you and my father, I don't care. I don't want to be involved. Mm-hmm. But she was like, no, you're either with me or against me.
Wow.
And basically me refusing just meant that I kept getting badly treated even more and more. And then at the end, in high school, you know, there was one time, I think she was asking me, why were you out late? And then she started like slapping me on the face. So to protect myself, I just pushed her away.
Mm-hmm.
And she called the cops and said to them, he beat me and I'm a disobedient child, you know? And that is actually part of the law at that time. I think maybe even now, if you call the cops on your kid, basically they can get arrested.
Wow.
Yeah, that is actually one of the main challenges for, you know, apostasy, like, in Saudi Arabia. Your parent could easily make a claim. And I've seen Saudi girls and on social media, right, nowadays in Twitter, they're complaining, like, yeah, I tried to stop my abusive father, but, you know, he was first, because right now we have, like, social services, you can complain against domestic violence. The government is trying.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that law that the parent can still call is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what happened between that for that girl, that her father called the cops first, so she got arrested. So anyway, so I got arrested that night. And that was 3 days away from my standardized exam. So that was the exam, the only chance I have to go to university. And she put me in prison 3 days before that exam. I had to take my book and study in prison. And anyway, so it's a good thing. Also, I was underage. I was 16. So the cops, I think they put me in my own cell so that, you know, not with the other inmates. But yeah, I mean, still, I started studying there because I realized I had no family. They don't give a shit about me. So I realized, you know what, I need to get out. I need to do something for myself. You know, if I don't do something for myself, no one will. And that's why I studied that night. And actually, I got very close to 100%. they needed, I think, 90% minimum to go to like another country to like a scholarship.
Yeah.
But so I got like 98. So. And it was the best grade. And anyway, it was one of the moments that I really realized that once I put my mind to something, you know, I can do it. You know, just sometimes I tell myself, well, you just have to believe in yourself because, well, if you don't trust yourself, then who is going to direct your life? Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Who's going to save you? There's a lot of good people, I realize, in this life. There's a lot of good people that care. But... yes, it has to come within you. It has to start with you. That's what I would say.
That's okay. really good advice, actually, because, you know, there's a lot of ex-Muslims out there that are in similar situations in Muslim countries, and this is what you need to do. Like, what you did is work hard, excel in school, and get out of the country on scholarship. I mean, that's impressive, and you
did that. You know what would happen if I confronted her that night? I mean, after 3 days, they took me to the court, you know, and I came in front of the judge and my mom was on the other side. You know, they unlocked my chains and let me stand in front of the judge. And then he said, okay, so are you going to apologize to your mom or not?
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if I say yes, I'll apologize, I go free. If I say no, I go for another 6 months. In jail.
What?
Yeah.
Damn.
And at that moment I thought, oh, I'm gonna say yes, but I'm coming back for your ass one day.
Yeah.
You lose
a battle, but you don't lose the war, right? You win the war.
Yeah. It's like I'm basically retreating this time, but I'm coming.
And doesn't the Quran say that it's okay to retreat in a situation like that? The Quran says you can retreat as a strategy.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I'll retreat. No problem.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
So just to jump in there for 1 second before you continue, you're not saying that you left Islam because your mother was a bad mother. We're not saying that. You're just giving the story of how you came to the realization that Islam is false, and this is all part of the journey.
I will tell you at the very end, because there's a very big point that I want to make at the very end of this. And that's why I want to leave it until then. Mm-hmm. But yes, I had so many questions, and I just want to tell you these questions, because when I at the end found the answers for them, I was happy. But before, I didn't know. So these questions were mainly, why did my mom never love me? Why did she mistreat me? Why did she mistreat my siblings? Why does she continue to mistreat my siblings? You know, I don't know. I didn't know why, but now I know. But I'll get to the end. So anyway, I got the scholarship, and I left. And it actually took almost 9 months until I got between when I got out of jail, did the exam, and graduated from high school. It took almost 9 months until the point where I left. But during all that time, I was just boiling from inside, you know, from what they did to me. You know, they literally wanted to destroy my future. That exam was everything. And they wanted to destroy the future, and they did not care. So I just sort of became numb from inside, you know. So anyway, I decided to bury things, you know, and I still believed in God. And, you know, it's like, yeah, your mom, obey your mom. You know, she has her reasons. And, you know, that's the truth that I accepted at that time. And I said, okay, that's good for me for now. That's the truth. There's a lot of unanswered thing, but let's just take all that stuff and put it behind those thick walls and forget them. So one thing that I want to also, I want to bring up to this point is that I have been suicidal since I was 11. Because of her lack of love, I didn't know how to make her happy. I even massaged her feet before she went to bed. She was a teacher, and she used to stand for very long hours, and she come back with the spider veins, you know, on her legs, and it would hurt. And I would come and massage her feet before she went to bed. You know, I tried to make her happy, and it was never enough, you know. So the thing is that I I started thinking that maybe was she, you know, because she was telling me, oh, I hope God burns you, you know, like it's a very easy, you know, parents say, like, you know, Allah ilanak, Allah, like God curse you, Allah yahigak, Allah kada. And it's like whenever you do bad things. So
wait, like, she used to curse you?
Yeah, like a lot. And it's like, it's almost like wishing death upon you. And I thought maybe the only way to make her happy is my own death.
So she's basically using the religious teachings against you, because she knows that she has this card, which is basically get out of jail card, which is you can't even say oof to her. She has the religious police to defend, the actual police to defend her as a parent in this culture, which is very conservative. And she has the religious teachings, and she's throwing the book against you, basically. Damn.
Yeah. So, Yeah, you know, it's just that she taught us to take it, you know, and we were indoctrinated to take it and never say anything back. So, but the thing is that my only defense mechanism is that, you know, why is she treating me that way? You know, maybe the only thing to make her happy, you know, is for me to die. So I thought that, like, at the age of 11, I was really terrified of reaching the taklif age, you know, taklif age.
The age of reasoning, right? But when you become
Bala. Yeah, the age when you can reason. And yeah. I was terrified of, okay, I'm afraid of straying. Like, you know, I'm afraid of growing up and losing my way. So I thought, God, please, I want to die now. I don't want to go to hell, you know? So anyway, and it's like, yeah, like if she is not happy, I'm going to hell for sure. So I wanted to die. I was like, even asking in my prayers, please, like, I want to die. Would that be possible? And anyway, so that sort of suicidal thoughts, like, kind of followed me until I was in university. And the thing is that because my mother, like, never gave me actually, like, compliment for achievement, you know, like, she would tell me, get the best grades you can. But, you know, whenever I actually showed her good grades, she said, you know, if it's 97%, well, why is it not 100? You know, it's like, what is this shit? Like, did I leave everyone? Did I leave all my family and to take care of you just so that you can bring me the shitty grades?
She's gaslighting you.
It's funny how she thinks, but, you know, like, it's anyway. So even when I went to university, whatever I did, whatever I achieved, I was never happy. I could never be happy. And, like, even, you know, my girlfriend was asked me, like, you know, my people around me, it's like, why aren't you happy? Like, you're doing okay. Why aren't you, like, why nothing makes you happy? So anyway, in a short answer, it's the self-defeating prophecies. Do not underestimate the power of self-defeating prophecies. When parents tell you something when you're young, most likely you will remember it, not possibly by word, but basically in your unconscious. It's something, it's like a belief, an unstated belief. So you have a belief, I am a shame to myself and to others. I am, you know, it's like, I have to prove myself. I have to prove that I'm okay. Like, inherently, you're shit, but you're shit until you prove that you're not shit, basically. Yeah. That's the sort of perspective. So to live on believing that, yeah, you're shit until you prove you're not shit, is that means unless you do very extraordinary things, like, you know, like Gagarin, you know, first guy to go to the space, you know, it's like, unless you do something extraordinary as that, you won't be proud of yourself. So it got worse, worse and worse and worse. I really wanted to die at some point. I really wanted to kill myself. But the thing is, the reason that stopped me was two things. Reason one, I have no idea. Like, at that point, I'm like, Islam is bullshit, but I'm not saying it explicitly. But it's like, this doesn't make any sense. Nothing makes any sense. But it's like, God doesn't give a shit if it makes sense or not. He's gonna burn me.
Yeah.
So I thought, I can't know for certain. I can't know for certain if there's death or, you know, just peaceful death, which would be great. Like, I don't want heaven. I don't want to live forever. Yeah. Like, it's boring. How many things you can do before you, like, you know, I don't know how many versions you have to do. I mean, for a guy in Muslim guy's heaven, and it's like, how many versions do you have to do until you, like, you know what? I think I'm good with all of you.
Yeah.
You know, so I always thought about this stuff, but it's like, I don't have answers. So, you know what? I'm not gonna risk it. Go die, and then, you know, this creepy God shows up, you know, after I die, or I guess they shows up in my grave and start to torture me forever.
Yeah.
It was a nightmare. Anyway, I sort of reached the point. Okay, I don't want to risk it, but at the same time, I'm not gonna give my mom the pleasure of me giving up. So actually, after I finished my bachelor, I started doing my master's, and at the very end, and that's the problem with me, it's always at the very, very end of doing something, I start to doubt myself. Is this true? Am I really about to finish my master's? I don't deserve it. You know, and if people knew the real person I was, they would not, you know. And it's like all of this self-destruction. I didn't realize that I have been torturing myself for my mom. You know, yeah. I didn't realize she programmed me to hate myself.
Mm-hmm. There's a name for that. It's called imposter syndrome, where you doubt yourself. Like, am I really an engineer? Am I really this good at what I am? Am I really this? Like, you self-doubt, basically, right? You question yourself, am I really going to get my master's? So what happened then?
Well, like I did with my bachelor's, I pushed through. I pressed, you know, stepped on all my depressions and questions. And 2 weeks, just forget everything. And I wrote my thesis, finished everything. And, you know, anyway, I my defense was also went very well. But, you know, I was like,
you were not happy though, right?
Huh?
But you were not happy though.
Yeah, no, like even at the end, it's like, well, I don't have a job yet. You know, who will hire me? If the people that will hire me knew that my thesis is not that great, like the analysis, they're like a simple analysis. You know, it's like, oh my God, like I always found a way to.
Self-doubt.
Like I always found a way. So anyway, so it was getting bad, and my girlfriend, she said to me, I think you should talk to a psychiatrist. And then I started talking to that psychiatrist. It was on an app on the phone. It's called BetterHelp. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it. You don't have to go to a psychiatrist personally. Oh, you can just talk to them on a video. And that one guy was very, very helpful. So this psychiatrist started talking to me, and he realized I had a lot of mommy's issues, you know? So he started, and then he, I got into him all the details that I just told you about. And so he said, are you sure you forgave your mom? Because I told him at the very beginning, but you know, like, don't worry about it. I already like forgave her. It's already passed it. You know, and I always like to describe myself as the rebel, as the black sheep, you know, but, you know, so the psychiatrist told me, I don't see you as a rebel. I see you as a victim. And that was the very first person that ever told me that. So anyway, he showed me a study. He showed me a study, and that's when I started really to question things. He showed me a study of, I think, 1920s. I have to verify. But 1920s, I think 100 babies that were abandoned by their own mothers. Either the mother died in birth, or basically they were just left. Mm-hmm. And so the study showed that many babies, due to the lack of mother's touch, due to the lack of mother carrying them, they actually died very young. So, yeah, so the psychiatrist really started to bring me that, okay, as a child, it's not just bringing you to life, 9 months, carrying 9 months in her belly, you know, that's not enough. You know, it's like feeding you, like we also feed cattle and then eat them. So I realized, oh yeah, that is right. And then I started to realize, he's like, okay, so what do you think? He started to ask me, okay, he's like, you answer this question. What do you think is mother responsibilities for her kids? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, teaching them good things, life skills. And he's like, you know, like being kind, being nice, like, you know, playing with your children, laughing with them. And he said, did she do that? No. So it's like, it's, you know, it's like, I always knew, but this, this sort of like walls was protecting all of this. You know, I was mm-hmm. just supposed to say, obey God and your mom and forget about it, you know? And so that's why I started to think, oh yeah, that makes sense. So anyway, so at the very beginning, I actually, like, when I started realizing, wow, I didn't really have a good childhood, like, that as this person didn't just, like, wasn't just rude to me. Like, she really almost made me kill myself. You know? So anyway, yeah. I got angry, and I told the psychiatrist, I want to go talk to her. And he's like, not yet. Wait. And so he recommended me to read this book. I highly recommend it. It was 60% of the work to actually reach peace today. It's called Toxic Parents by Dr. Susan Forward. So, you know, even the thing is that I just want to bring to your attention something. You know, hearing this story that, you know, it's my mother basically physically and emotionally abused her children. But if you tell me, okay, take away the physical abuse and I'm just going to leave the emotional abuse, it still would be so terrible, because mm-hmm. the things she told me, it was absolutely horrendous. It was the reason I wanted to kill myself, mm-hmm. because she made me believe that the only way that she would be happy is me dead.
Wow.
So I didn't realize that I've been living trying to fulfill that wish. You know, her asking God to make me fail, I've been just waiting. When am I going to get punished? When am I getting punished? Like, I'm just like looking behind my back. When am I getting punished? You know? So, emotional, I like to say that if you have a problem, you know, if you have a problem with your parents, not just parents, relative family, then you have a problem. You don't have to compare it. You don't have to compare it to anyone. Your yeah. suffering is real for you. So it should be real. So don't go to the comparison. Never go to the comparison. You know, find your answer. What do you need? Sometimes we really need to dig for that answer that would bring us peace about whatever that we went through. So anyway, going from there, I went on with the therapy for almost like 4 months. And in that time, I started talking to my sister, and I found out from her that my mom still beats her, that, well, she once slapped her on the face in public, and she's 21 years old.
Wow.
And I was like, you did all this to me and you're still doing it to my little sister.
Yeah.
It got me more angry. And then I got even more angry because my little sister told me my uncle did something to my older sister. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hell no, I'm not standing by. I'm not being silent this time.
This is a religious uncle, the one with the big beard, the one that told your mom to burn the pictures of your childhood because of haram. The same one. Yeah.
With the golden rosemary, subhanAllah. Yeah. It turns out my sister was not the only one. Mm-hmm. He has done this to his, because my mother is like his half sister. So he has other sister from his father. Because his father actually married two women. It was my grandmother, which is my mother's mom, and then there's another woman that he was married to. So they had a lot of sisters, and it was actually becoming something known between the girls of the family, which my little sister knew, that this guy was doing stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so anyway, so the moment came, which is about a month ago, a little more than a month, when the psychiatrist told me, okay, if you want to confront, I think you're ready for that. So, and that's what I also want most people to understand. Like, don't announce leaving the religion. Don't do any of that until you're absolutely safe, absolutely taken care of. Plan everything. Don't just do, you don't rush these things, you know? That's why the psychiatrist told me, don't do it now. But then 4 months later, he's like, yes, I think you're okay. But yeah, so anyway, so I was very, very scared. I'm a muscular guy. Like, I'm not weak physically, you know? But the thing is that it's like, this is the monster that terrorized me all my childhood. And I was still afraid of her, even at that moment. And so when I started basically to confront her, and I told her, he did this, he did that. The thing is, I didn't expect an apology. I know she wouldn't apologize. I know what sort of person she is. And that was confirmed. She told me that it was her Allah-given right to beat. And that... oh, look at you. You're successful now. So, that's supposed to be an accomplishment for her. I was like, well, I got what I got because I fought through it. I studied in jail.
Yeah. Despite what you did, not because. Despite
what you did.
Yeah, exactly.
she's like, oh my God, so cold. So cold. I started to feel sorry for how cold she was. But when I actually confronted her about my sister, I was like, how did you allow this? You terrible, terrible mother. How did you allow this?
Yeah.
And she said, oh, I tried to talk to him. I told him to stop.
Wow. So she knew about it.
Yeah, she knew about it. So I
honestly don't understand people like that. Like, I know my wife.
It's about
she would probably murder someone who did this. Like, she'd probably take a knife.
Someone did this to my child.
But like, yeah. I don't understand parents that let the kids be. I don't get it. Like, it's just. I mean, I'm said my wife, but I would probably murder him too. Like, it's.
Oh my God! Not in any society, anyone would blame you because you know what? It's the mother, the father instinct. It's the parent instinct. It's in us to
exactly.
It's like our children.
Oh man!
And anyway, so that's why I'm saying psychopath. And honestly, this answer brings me peace because if you look at read the story, hear the story and compare what the website says, you'll find that many of that characteristic, this lack of empathy, really corresponds to a person with that sort of mental state. And anyway, that day I went nuclear because I screenshotted the chat with her and I posted it on the family WhatsApp group. 40 people. Yeah. And anyway, so at that moment I thought, okay, so everyone is gonna be like, okay, let's resolve this privately. Bring the guy, like, I don't know, take him to a psychiatrist or take him to their sheikh or, like do something. Just do fucking something, you know? And I didn't expect like punishment because, well, it's a different society over there. But yeah. I thought something, please. And no, they called me a liar. And it's like, you just hate your mom. You beat your mom before you left. That's when she was like slapping me in the face. And I
to
defend myself. They're like, yeah, we have a police report that shows you beat your mom. And they called me, almost an infidel and dishonorable person that I'm just holding grudges against my mom, and despite whatever she's done, I'm an ungrateful little shit. My brother told my father I would bury him if I was you. My stepfather, well, the guy that married my mom, he also told my father the same thing because now it's his wife's reputation, basically. And And yeah, my one of my uncle told me, if I hope you find, he said, oh, I hope you find a lawyer so you can stay, because yeah, I challenge you to come back. Well, but just to bring your opinion, my father is actually pursuing legal action against them in Saudi Arabia. So I'll definitely show them who is not brave enough to come back. But anyway, yeah, so one guy said, oh, and one of my uncles, who's very religious also, who defended his sexual abuser brother, he said, oh, you've made a lot of enemies, and I wouldn't be surprised if whoever killed you got away with it. Sneaky, sneaky bastards. Anyway, so yeah, so that was, and the thing is,
I was just going to say, so do you think that because you've actually brought this up now in public in front of everyone, even though they claimed that you're lying, everybody now knows this guy did it? Do you think they believe you, actually, but they're just saying that?
Look, it's strange. I don't know if they know. I don't know if they actually believe the lie or not, because they're like, I showed them the confession. You know, I could share
your mother.
I could share it for you for the Arabic speakers. They can see it. But anyway, you know, I showed them the confession. She's like, yeah, I knew that he did this, and I stopped him, and I showed them, and they're like, no, you I don't know, photoshopped it, or like you're a liar, or I don't get it. And even my little sister, I told her, like, please come here.
Yeah.
You know, like, my father is there. Just come to my father. Like, he will bring you here. Because my father actually, like, I really respect him for this. He believed everything, and he stood by my side. Mm-hmm. And you know, I told her, like, go to my father. Like, do you want to continue being slapped when you're 21? The thing is that, like, I don't blame her. She's, like, very indoctrinated, like, under the compulsion. She's like, no, my mother beat us because it was for our own good. Mm. And I told her, what about your sister? And she's like, oh, it was just touching.
Jeez.
And they convinced her that way. You know, like, she convinced her that our reputation is more important than, you know, than what happened to your sister. And
wow,
asshole getting, you know, getting what he deserves.
Jeez, this is, why is that? Is that the culture?
It is the culture, and it is Islam.
Yeah.
You know, you know the hadith. It's like, I think it was that guy, like, the prophet was asking, you know, if someone slept with your wife, and he's like, yeah, at that time he said, yeah, we'll kill him.
And the ghira, you're talking about the ghira, right?
Huh?
The hadith about ghira.
Yeah, about the, oh, yes, exactly, absolutely that one. And he's like, yeah, if, you know, I am more, and my father, and, like, God is, like, even more. So it's like, yeah, like, you know, they really fear shame more than they care about the actual victim.
Wow.
I mean, I used to listen from these, like, you know, like, Sheikh Al-Arifi. That's, like, a very famous Saudi scholar, lecturer, he actually.
Yeah.
Da'iya, they call him. So he, Arifi, there is, Tariq al-Sudan, all these people. And they used to talk about honor crimes, like honor killing. Like, it's like, oh, it sucks, like, for both parties. You know, they're like, when they actually tell the story of, like, the girl getting killed by her parents.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, it's unfortunate, you know, that it ended that way. It's like, what if the girl, because you didn't teach her anything about sex, you didn't teach her about anything about how to deal with boys, that, you know, she was just stupid. I mean, enough to go with this guy, and then he abducted her, and then he raped her.
Yeah.
Like, no, yeah, it's unfortunate. That's it, you know, dead, both. And wow. And I heard this story, like, it was basically, you know, the father, basically her father, after she got raped, you know, her father basically started telling her, like, he's like, oh, I know you repented, but it's like, there's no undoing this. And then he, like, went and took his gun and shot her.
This was a case that happened. You're talking about,
yeah,
a case.
Yeah, and so, yeah, and that was, like, told in the mosque by one of those preachers. Yeah, and basically, yeah. So she went on with a guy, you know, just like a, you know, an innocent date, and basically he took and raped her. And basically, I don't know, he took her pictures or whatever, but yeah, she, you know, her family found out, the religious police basically brought her home. But then, yeah, her father, because of the shame, he just killed her.
Wow.
And they mention it, and they talk about it. They talk about it. Oh, yeah.
They don't kill the guy. They kill the woman.
Yeah, they killed the, mainly, you know, they actually, there's actually a saying in Saudi Arabia. Which means like the bad reputation of a guy is in his own pocket, it's hidden, but when a woman shames herself, it's like it's out in the open. So actually, yeah, so women doing basically, you know, fucking around, let's just say it in that you know, open language, right, is not allowed, but guy doing it is like, yeah, as long as he doesn't tell anyone, he's okay. But the woman, well, if she doesn't bleed when, you know, on the consummation, the night of consummation, when she gets married, well, that's a problem. So anyway, it's, you know, the thing is, I always knew about all this injustice. It's just that it was like in this area of my brain, it's like, you can't ask these questions. You can't doubt. You're not allowed. If you do ask about these things, you will get burned. So anyway, I'll wrap up to the end of the story where I want to actually state my moments of coming out of the religion. The realization, basically, that came to me.
Yeah.
So after talking with my mom, and I even confronted my uncles, and I told them to fuck off. You know, it felt really good telling the people off who mistreated me, scared me, terrorized me as a child. Because my mom, when she wasn't able to beat me when I was older, she used my uncles because, well, they're tougher. They're guys, you know? So anyway, so I was very happy. I was relieved, but there was something in there. I was like, okay, I realized I had a bad mom. Okay, I got it now. So that's why I got mistreated. It wasn't because I was bad. It was because of her being a bad mother. But still, why? Why would she do all of that? Why would she be a bad mother? Like, the fact that she got mistreated is, it's not a good answer. You know, because, well, like, I got mistreated and I didn't go have children and beat them. You know, so what is it? So anyway, so I'm thinking that night, like I'm trying to sleep, and my mental health was definitely improved, but as I told you, there's still something missing. There's something unanswered. And I was willing to go through anything to get that, to get answers with the questions. I was like, I don't care what I find the answer. I'll find the answer. So anyway, so I'm about to sleep. And then I think, what if I go to heaven? Would my uncle be there? And then I remember the ayah from the Quran. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَغْفِرُ أَن يُشْرَكَ بِهِ وَيَغْفِرُ مَا دُونَ ذَلِكَ لِمَن يَشَاءُ. And that is basically means that God will forgive any sin, literally any sin, except for polygamy. Shirk.
Yeah.
For worshiping, shirk, yeah, worshiping another
God. Polytheism, yeah.
Yeah, polytheism is, yeah. You know. Okay, so let's see. My uncle, he prays 5 times a day. He fasts. He goes to Hajj. Did I forget something? He's a good Muslim. So, yeah, he sinned. Yeah, he, you know, sexually abused his niece. But everything seems clear. He's clear to go to heaven.
Yeah.
So at that moment, I realized it wasn't hell. It wasn't heaven. This wasn't heaven. This was hell. Allah is evil. It's like it hits me. It was like, Allah is evil. And then it's like a surreal, something like magic, you know. It was like a blanket taken off my brain, you know. And I started I stood around and I was like, oh my fucking God. Like, what? What? I can't believe it. This was all bullshit. It was like this, like, and anyway, so I'm in this sort of strange feeling. It's like, you know, I'm realizing that, wait a second, Abraham, think about, like, you know, the father of the Abrahamic religions, Abraham himself. He left his father and all his family, all his tribe. He abandoned them, left them all, because they were polytheists, right? You know, when God asks you, you obey, even if your family.
Yeah.
He took his son Ishmael and his wife Hagar and throw them in the desert, 700 kilometers away from Jerusalem, you know, in the middle of the desert, just because God asked him to. And then when his son finally came back to him, he almost killed him because God told him so.
Yeah.
So I was like, am I really surprised? Like, why am I very surprised that she treats her children that way? It's conditional love. Mm-hmm. It's God love. It's conditional.
Yeah.
Anyway, when I realized that, it was Allah all along. God told her to. It was not a beautiful answer. It was not like flowers. It was not very nice. It was dark and it was stupid. It was very, very, you know, very dark realization, but it was the truth. I felt it with all my heart and soul, and it brought me peace. I realized I don't need to persuade her love and, you know, satisfaction anymore.
Amazing. Yeah. So you found parallels in the psychopathic behavior of Abraham to what your mom was doing. You found realization in the fact that even, you know, the worst people, when people talk about justice, they always say, well, what about justice? But what kind of justice is that where if just because you're a Muslim, you get to go to heaven no matter what? Sure, you might be punished for some time, but the best non-Muslim will go to hell forever.
Stephen Hawking, Einstein, Bohr,
yeah,
all the people responsible for modern science today, majority non-Muslims, so they're all going to hell.
Which also has led to the greatest quality of life improvement for most of the world, right? Like, we're talking about like glasses and innovation and, you know, like, we're raising the global wealth level, you know, little by little. And it's science that's allowed us to live the way we're living now. Without science, you know, we wouldn't have ever got to where we are now. Most, we'd still be getting, you know, still be having 12 kids, 8 of which would die at childbirth. You know, there's the example of the first ever guy who got antibiotics. He was scratched by a thorn and he was about to die, and they gave him antibiotics, which, you know, they happened to, as a test, they didn't have enough. So he got better, miraculously got better, but then they didn't have enough because this was the very first batch of antibiotics they came up with, you know, penicillin, and then he died. People used to die from getting bit by an animal. Like, it's just, yeah, the life quality was not there. Like, you would, it's just, you know, we had to chop off your hand.
I had an appendix surgery as a child. So yeah, if you don't remove the appendix, it explodes inside and, well, you die. So without modern medicine, I wouldn't be alive. It's not without God, without modern medicine, I wouldn't be alive. You know, it pissed me off. Like, when, you know, it's like people really do good things, and instead of thanking people, you thank God. I know, it's funny. I recently kind of reached out to my supervisor, the supervisor that I did my master's with. And I told him, I started to talk to him about, like, making a paper, publishing a paper in a conference. And I said, yeah, we'll put your name and my name, and then, you know, we'll work on it and get it done and show you. But anyway, so then I told him, and as I was talking with him on Zoom, I said, you know what? Thank you very much for not letting me thank God in my thesis. Because I tried. I was planning to. But unfortunately, I did thank my mom. But anyway, at least I didn't thank God. Thank God I didn't thank God in my thesis.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So it's been quite a journey, quite a realization, and there's a lot to reflect on. Now that you know you're at this point now, obviously you're starting to see a lot more problems in Islamic society, in Muslim society, that you never thought of before. Things that, like you said, they're in the back of your mind, but you just never reflected, or you make an excuse for it because
it's not
like,
allowed to. It's danger zone. It's not that you don't want to go venture. Like, I mean, a friend of mine, when I told him his Russian, and you know, most people in Russia, you know, because of Soviet Union, they're irreligious mostly. So yeah, so he told me, you're an engineering, you're like in a very specific technology field, and yeah, you just, you know, became like, you just became atheist. And I told him, look, you didn't grow up in a religious family. You don't know how much these people take religion so seriously.
Yeah.
They take it so seriously. They don't see family. They don't see brother. They don't see anything. They see, yeah, like, are we going to go to heaven together? Or, you know what, if you're kafir, if you're going to go to hell, you know, well, I don't want to know you. So, and that, yeah, that is now most of my family. I mean, my father is still Muslim. But and I did tell him, I don't, you know, sorry, I don't believe in this BS anymore. And he just told me, it's like he just said, it's up to you. You know, you're my son. And, you know, if Allah wants something, you know, like Allah wants it. I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. But anyway, like I do respect my father very much, you know, yeah, because he actually stood up for those assholes back home and
against them,
against them. And at the same time, when I told him, hey, I don't believe in God, he loved his son more than he loved his religion. And that's what Abraham wasn't.
or at least you can say that even from his perspective, it would make more sense to not cut you off and basically throw you out, and to keep a relationship with you in hopes that maybe you'll come back to Islam. He's able to...
I think my father... No, my father is very... I know what you're saying, but
yeah,
it's not that case, because my father was always... I think he himself, he makes fun of religion a lot. Yeah. But he, like, he's not like, you know, if you insult... I remember once when we were talking about, like, the people who get very angry when Muhammad, peace be upon him, you know, gets insulted, right? You know, he was like, yeah, I don't see people who exaggerating, like, you know, he was a human just like us.
Yeah.
You know? Like, yeah, you know, but he's like, I don't see it. Why? So I don't think he ever like enforced his religious beliefs. And even sometimes it's funny. There was one time I was looking for a Vietnamese dish.
Yeah.
And it was basically coming like, it's basically an incomplete egg formation, but it
was... Oh, it's a Filipino dish, balut, something like
balut,
that.
Balut, yes. There we go. So anyway, so he was asking me, can you look for it? Like, I'm interested, because we were watching like a food show.
Yeah.
And then I'm reading the Wikipedia page, and it's basically, it's in Arabic. Actually it was in English. At the last paragraph, it's like, and it's prohibited to eat balut in Islam because, I was like, this is a secular platform. Why is there, someone who wrote in Wikipedia that it's haram? You know, by the way, balut is haram in Islam. You look it up, you'll see. I tried to get into the Wikipedia to remove it because it's like, it's not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I still sort of, but anyway, so my father basically said, but my father was, what he said was, why are you reading to me the hukm in Islam? You know, why are you reading me the verdict? And he's like, yeah, just talk to me like in a scientific term. I was like, look, it's out of my control. Like, they put it in Wikipedia. but my father, I mean, my father, he's an engineer himself. Mm-hmm. So he's a scientific mind. And I don't think he stayed, you know, because he's hoping that I will come back one day.
Yeah.
He just told me, yeah. So he told me, you know, you're still my son, and mm-hmm. and I love you. So I like to believe that he really does, and I think I've grown to love my father more after this. I never really knew the meaning of loving a parent, you know, until this point, because I just, even my father, I thought of him, I was like very suspicious of him all the time, you know. It's like, I thought he was like just gonna be like my mom, you know. And so even though he didn't mistreat me, he didn't beat me, but I always had this thought, family can be trusted. But after the situation, after his fatherhood was put to test, I saw his real.
That's amazing. That's I'm happy for you for that part. Definitely, you know, whatever the situation is with him in Saudi or wherever he is now, I hope he's well, and you know, maybe one day he'll also see this and see the guidance in this. But you know, being in a Muslim country, it's hard to really leave Islam, and it's better to be like you know, skeptical, or maybe be a little bit agnostic rather than to leave Islam openly, or even leave Islam, because everything around you is Islam in that society, right? So
yeah.
But like what you said is true, that Islam does teach you to, you know, cut off family members that are against the religion. Like, you're not allowed to support them in any way. You're not allowed to inherit. If you're a non-Muslim kid, you know, technically you don't get any inheritance. You know, if you're married, like in my case, your wife will be divorced from you. All of those things, you know. So I'm glad you're in a non-Muslim country, and you're doing well. You're, you know, safe away from these toxic people. That it's not just Islam that's toxic, but it's also the family as well as toxic. You know, that just makes it twice as difficult. And, you know, I applaud your bravery at coming out, at, you know, confronting these devils, you know, and dealing with them properly. And I hope that even, you know, even though they claim that they don't believe you, at least people know now that this guy, at least they have some sort of question in the back of the mind that, you know, can we trust this guy with our daughters? And, you know,
I feel also that way, like that I at least prevented, you know, a future girl from falling to be one of his victims. Yeah, they're not gonna believe me, but at least there's doubt, and doubt does something.
Exactly. So now that you know, again, thank you for sharing the story. And I don't think people even realize how difficult it can be, but especially to even show your face and talk about these things. So now that you've done this, what is your hope for, you know, Muslim countries or the Middle East? What is your dream? What do you think is the future over there?
You know, I've always, you know, when I thought about politics, because I was very interested in politics when I was a kid, and I saw how the outside world is, and I saw how the country is. But the thing is that it's not black and white. And Middle Eastern countries right now, they're slowly moving into secularism. And the problem with moving towards secularism is the religious fanatics. It's the conservative. It's the likes of my uncle. These people, they are willing to, you know, they're willing to go violent. They're willing, you know. But the thing is that the new government in Saudi Arabia, people know what goes around, and I don't want to, but I'm not here to discuss any of that. What I'm discussing is that how are things changing in terms of women rights? That's what I really care about. And I have seen improvement, and I hope that things keep improving, and I hope next they will abolish the apostate law entirely. Flogging and stoning has already been abolished. These were legitimate sentences in Saudi Arabia. Not anymore. The new system has took the religious police out of out of power. They can now, the only thing they can do is give you a pamphlet. Like they used to be able to drag you from your shop to the mosque. And so I see the improvement, and I acknowledge it, and I hope for more. I hope we have an anti-religion, not anti-religion, but basically to take the West way of secularism, to keep religion in the freaking mosque, keep it in the church, keep it in the synagogue, keep it in the temple. Stop like forcing your morality on other people. I think it's very important. It's an overriding priority that Middle Eastern countries reach this point. It's our only way to do better for our children and to do better for the countries.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, I think that's a great place to end off with, you know, hope for the future, improvement, and, you know, secularism, women's rights, all of the things that we're fighting for, all of the reasons why I have this channel, why I love to talk to people like yourself. You know, you've only been ex-Muslim for 3 weeks. It's so funny, in the comments, people are, you know, one guy was like, oh no, he was always apostate or something. He was never Muslim or something like that, which is funny. But, you know, truly you were attached emotionally and you were connected to this religion. Like this was your life and this was what you grew up in. You didn't have a choice in the matter because your parents are Muslim. They raised you as Muslim. You're in a Muslim society. But somehow you managed to find your way out. In this case, it was a very tragic event that shook you and made you reconsider. Because a lot of the times what happens is these events are the catalyst that allow us to reconsider. For some people, it's either a divorce. Some people, it's a death of a loved one. Some people, it's a near-death experience. And you find even people become Muslim sometimes. You know, they go the opposite direction. They're like, oh, I had a near-death experience. What's the purpose of life? And then they make up a purpose. Like, oh, my purpose is to be religious Muslim. And they become religious and they dive into it. But thankfully, you found the proper way out, which is you've become the master of your own life now. You have seen, like you said at the beginning, that the snow seems whiter, the grass is greener. You now see beauty. You want to talk about that a little bit before we end?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's like I told you, I had questions, and why did she not love me? Why? And then the question that came to me later: would I see him in heaven? And these two questions, you know, when I found the answer, like I said, despite being painful, they, like, you know, it's like I was a bad child. I always talked about myself as a bad child, a rebel, a black sheep. I realized I was no rebel. I was no black sheep. I was just living my life. And the thing is, when I finally stopped torturing myself, when I finally stopped, I looked back and, my God, I finished university. I finished my master's. It's like, no, it was good. And yeah. I was able to take my hand and say, good boy.
Well done.
And well, you know, that sort of standing up for my family, to God and to everyone, you know, sort of gave me the confidence again. You remember I told you like about the childhood passion that I enjoyed reading everything. You know, I found a way to enjoy something I read, even though it wasn't in my area of interest. And that I find that passion is back. I'm like, once again, like, wondrous, how does this work? How does this work? How do you fix a car? How do you fix a roof? Like I started doing hobbies, stuff that I've always thought, oh, I can't do this. I wouldn't excel if I tried to do it. So the thing is that I also realized I'm 26. I already have a master. I already had a job. 50 more years, 60 more years in life, I'll take it. But at the end, I'm happy that once I pass away, I will become once again one with the universe. And that idea, that thought brings me peace.
You know, it's amazing because a lot of people wonder, how can you be at peace with the idea that we just die and that's it? But you can.
You know, like it's yeah, I know, like the thought of that you're become nothing, But it's when you think about it in the, you know, in the scientific way of the entropy, right? Something that life is high entropy, you know, but in the same way that it's going, always going into high entropy, you know, it's sort of productive in such a way because of this trend of going to high, always to high entropy. You have galaxies forming, stars forming. You have a crazy universe, life blooming. And I think there are other planets, probably, maybe, you know, it doesn't make sense. Trillions of planets that we're only here because we're special. And because Mecca is here, you know. So anyway, you know, it's like, you know, do your purpose, live your life, leave a very good offspring, you know, that will treat this planet well. And I'm sure that, well, if you physically are not here, your memory will still live on. Just be a good person.
Absolutely. And make the most of your life. I mean, mindfulness, just to be in the moment, just to find peace and every little beauty, stop and smell the flowers, like you put it. I mean, that all of that makes sense. And to me, and I think a lot of people that were used to, like, they came from a theism, that have this sort of like, they think they need God. They think they need an afterlife. But
I thought too.
Yeah.
And you know, at the end, I realized, having a brutal God in the back of my mind was actually making my life worse and worse. And no matter how I tried to fix my life by praying more, I just became more miserable.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, too. It didn't actually help.
Yeah.
And the religious teachings didn't help either, right?
Well, the religious teaching doesn't tell you answer. It just tells you, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تَسْأَلُوا عَنْ أَشْيَاءٍ تُبْدَلَ لَكُمْ تَسُؤْكُمْ. Oh, believers, don't ask about things that will become clear to you. It will, like, not be good for you. What a mob mafia god.
Yeah, because he got stuck in contradictions the more he answered things, right?
Yeah, it's like religion is supposed to be the answer of everything, yet there's a question we're not supposed to ask. But anyway. So anyway, you know, I feel like if I talked about, you know, a lot of my insights, I will go on forever. So I'll leave it for you. If you have any more questions, let me know.
Yeah, so a lot of people are saying thank you to you. Thank you. You really helped. You know, they found that what you said was similar to what they're going through, and they found a lot of reassurance in your journey and your story. So again, thank you for that. And just to reiterate, we are now episode 84 of the Friendly Ex-Muslim podcast. You can check this out on iTunes and Stitcher because it is a long format. If you don't have YouTube Premium, you know, you want to listen to the audio rather than having it open on your YouTube. Of course, watching on YouTube helps the channel. So do watch on YouTube. But for convenience purposes, there's always the podcast platform. Also, those of you who are new here, please consider subscribing. The channel is, I'm trying to get the channel back up to 60,000 subs, almost hit 60,000 and then lost the channel monetization, had to start from scratch. So that's a bit of a pain, but I'm going to get there. Like the chat, like the live stream if you enjoyed it. If you didn't enjoy it, like it anyways. And thank you. Because you are using a pseudonym and you know you want to keep your privacy, I'm not gonna link any of your social media. But if you do decide to create like
it's not now, but the time is coming. I still have hope that my sister will go back to her senses one day. So that's the only reason, but I there is nothing left for me back home. It's just that I don't want to close doors that you know, I could help in ways, you know, I could help the new rising feminist movement in Saudi Arabia, you know. There is I see willingness from government right now to go into things. So I don't see politics, like I said, as black and white. If things can be improved for children all around the world, not just in Saudi Arabia, if women's rights can be improved and men and women made equal in Saudi Arabia, then that's a very noble goal, and I should do my best to reach it.
Absolutely. Every single voice we have really helps, because each person has their own people that they connect to, right? And their own circle of influence and all that. And, you know, a thousand lights make the sun, 1,000 candles can make the sun, right? So we definitely need whatever we can. And
I see very brave women. I see very, very brave women on Twitter, Saudi women, and they, especially Nojain al-Hadloul and the other activists, and they are, my God, like they have more bravery than me. They're standing against the society while they're in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
They are in Saudi Arabia and they're studying against the rigid and backward society values. So I salute people like Lujain and many other brave women in Saudi society. And I hope if I can help that I would be in help.
You definitely are helping. And honestly, thank you again. So, okay, everyone. So we're going to wrap it up there. It's been 90 minutes. Thank you for joining. If you missed it, do check it out later. And thank you, Mikhail. And we'll hopefully have you on again in the future. Bye.
Thank you, Samir. Bye.